In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Groups of right-wing extremist Israeli settlers in several places inside the occupied West Bank took to smashing windows and cars of Palestinians in apparent protest of the Israeli government's evacuation of the illegal Maoz Esther outpost over the weekend as part of their so-called price tag policy response to the state's watered-down plan to dismantle a few illegal outposts. Maoz Esther has been dismantled and rebuilt several times before. Preceding the settler attacks, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday vowed to, quote, never evict Israeli settlers from the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, as a Tel Aviv University opinion poll in Israel showed a 66% majority of the Israeli population backs his plan to continue building colonies in the occupied territories. This afternoon in the occupied Gaza Strip, U.S.-made and financed Israeli warplanes bombed several places at the southern border at Rafah Crossing, alleging that the strikes were targeting smuggling tunnels. Because of the two-year-old blockade, Palestinians have maintained tunnel networks in order to bring in supplies, including food, water, medicine, livestock, and gas. Israel accuses Palestinian resistance factions of using the tunnels primarily for weapons smuggling. Several crude homemade mortar rockets were fired from Gaza into open areas on the other side of the Gaza wall today. And finally, in the West Bank, the 6th General Conference of the Fatah Party wrapped up, and Palestinian Authority's Quisling President Mahmoud Abbas was reconfirmed as the de facto party leader. However, according to a report published in Al Jazeera, refugees in the regional diaspora say they expect little from the ruling party in the context of long-term commitments to the 61-year-old refugee issue. Joining us to talk about all of this is our special correspondent, John Elmer. John is a freelance photojournalist and reporter. He writes for Interpress Service and joins us once again from Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. John, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin with your assessment of the 6th Fatah Conference. What was accomplished? What questions people are telling you were left out of the discussion, especially in reference to the refugee crisis and the expanding collaboration with Israeli and U.S. interests and that little issue of American-led training camps in counterinsurgency techniques against their own people. Give us your assessment. What was significant about this conference that was held right there in Bethlehem?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important to say the conference isn't over. I mean, it's been an endless conference that continues on based on the fact that there appears to be discussions within the sort of rank and file of the party versus the sort of party dictate, which has led the Fatah party from the sort of forefront of the secular resistance here in Palestine for the last 40 years into something that you could describe in your lead as collaborationist, which I think is perfectly accurate. And if he went and knocked on the door and, you know, the average Palestinian home, whatever that means, you know, you'd get the same kind of explanation. You know, there's still quite a bit to be decided in the conference. But some of the interesting trends were that there's been several rank-and-file motions asking for such things as accountability on the financing for Fatah for the past, particularly 20 years, related to the Oslo peace process, where we've seen literally billions of dollars in international aid, predominantly American and European aid, effectively disappear. It's not easy to see when you're looking around here in the West Bank or in Gaza either, and see what has been built out of this entire massive apparatus of international funding that has happened for the Palestinian Authority and, of course, the NGOization, if I can use a mouthful word like that, the use of this extreme funding to international bodies where foreign workers are coming here and, you know, doing the carrying out these sort of democracy promotion and development apparatuses that the average Palestinian on the street has had no benefit from. And so, you know, there's been a challenge that's taken place of the top leadership. However, I don't think anybody is holding their breath here on any massive change within the Fatah movement, which has been basically become the Palestinian Authority. The Fatah party has essentially swallowed itself into this collaborationist disposition whereby nothing they do is not approved by the Americans, and of course nothing the Americans are, you know, is doing is separate from the Israelis. So you end up having this sort of triumvirate running the situation on the national level for the Palestinians since the early 1990s and arguably even before that. So, I mean, there's been the city of Bethlehem has been besieged by Fatawis who are here at the conference, and it's interesting just anecdotally since people can read about what's going on, but I can tell you from looking at it that you can see the corruption on the streets itself. Often you have, just anecdotally, you have mobs of Mercedes, BMWs, and Audis jockeying for parking spots in a situation where you have 50% unemployment in the Gaza Strip. You know, you have 90% of the population dependent on food aid, living on $2 a day. Yet you have this political apparatus that's, raked in personal profits at the expense of their people for the last 15 years. And none of this is lost on the average Palestinian. And it appears, judging by the ferocity of the discussions that are happening in the cafes all around Bethlehem, but also at the conference itself, who several reports, I'm not in the conference, I didn't get access to the conference itself, it's closed to the media, reports coming out have reported pretty fiery exchanges between rank-and-file members, challenging their leadership. But like I said, I don't think anyone is holding their breath on a major change in Fatah policy.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, John Elmer, speaking to us from the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem. And John, you were able to speak with several officials of the Hamas party or people associated with Hamas in the context of these conferences. Can you talk a little bit about the reaction from the opposition party?
Well, I mean, principally, the Fatah movement has become the Palestinian Authority, as we said, and as we've talked about on your show last week, it has manifested itself more particularly in the creation of these security forces headed by Mohammed Dahlan, who's the CIA strongman, and have been under the auspices of American General Keith Dayton. And so these forces are out in full effect in several major West Bank cities, including here in Bethlehem, to create what Tony Blair calls these model cities. Well, these model cities have been created at the expense of the elected government of Hamas, two-thirds of their cabinet was imprisoned. You still have one-third of the PLC, the Palestinian Legislative Council, in prison. You have 1,000 Fatah or 1,000 Hamas activists in Fatah prisons. You had today the 11th Hamas member to be tortured to death just since the Salam Fayyad Keith Dayton overthrow in the West Bank after the Hamas takeover in Gaza. You have a strategy from the Americans run through the Israelis and through the Palestinian Authority to carry out what they call the Dawa strategy, which is to attack the social infrastructure of Hamas and to attack it both by putting its democratically elected leaders in prison, but also attacking its social infrastructure, which has created a lot of the popular support for Hamas on the ground. And so, discussing with Hamas leaders, you get a real take on this. I spoke with Aziz Dueck, the Speaker of the Parliament today, who is, because of the fact that Mahmoud Abbas's term as President of the Palestinian Authority has expired, under Palestinian law, Aziz Dueck is the President. But he's been in prison for the last 3 years, arrested by Israel, after the taking of a Israeli soldier capture in Gaza in 2006, the Hamas cabinet and, as I said, the Palestinian Legislative Council, a significant portion of which was Hamas, was arrested and imprisoned, so prevented from functioning by arrest by Israel. And then this void was filled by Salam Fayyad and the Mahmoud Abbas collaborators within the Palestinian Authority. And so you have a situation where an elected government is under siege, both from the Israeli occupation, but also from this collaborationist forces of Keith Dayton. And so, on the one hand, someone like Aziz Dueck has been at the forefront of the attempt to reconcile between Fatah and Hamas. And so he speaks quite cordially about the situation, hoping to get Fatah and Hamas to come together. because Palestinians, of course, don't see much hope if they can't have a unified movement, and Israel can't have a peace process without both those major forces being on side. So Aziz Dueck has taken it sort of upon himself to be the mediate between the two parties. But on the other hand, several senior Hamas leaders that I've interviewed here in the West Bank choose to go anonymous in the interviews because anything they say is literally held against them to the point of arrest. And who are these 1,000 Hamas activists in prison? I mean, you have from everything from, this, as I say, the Speaker of the House, who is now officially the technically the president, all the way down to school teachers, Hamas journalists, people associated with Hamas media in any way. You have the mosques are being raided. You have the orphanages, administrations overhauled. And so these people are, not just Hamas, but anybody within the resistance movement are afraid to speak for fear of being arrested by their own people. And so it's a real situation on the ground where you have both the Israeli siege as well as this collaborationist element that's, dealing on the ground every day with its own people. And it's really this situation across the board that's created a real numbness within Palestinian society, and a situation where at any given day when you're sitting and having coffee and just, just chatting, people are quite forthcoming in saying that these are the worst days that Palestinians have experienced. You know, after 10 years of intifada, after, 60 years of displacement and 100 years of displacement, but 60 years of the State of Israel's displacement and project against the Palestinians, you have today that still going on, as well as the real sharp end of the spear in many cases is coming from the Palestinians themselves, a small group of Palestinians that are acting in collaboration with Israeli forces. You have Palestinians arrested one night by the Palestinians, and then the next night the Israelis come in and use the exact information from the Dayton forces interrogations to arrest family members here in the camps. That's going on every night. And so it is a real situation where Palestinians are saying, that they've never seen anything like this. It's brother on brother, as well as what the Israeli occupation has wrought for the last years.
John, let's talk a little bit about how the Western corporate media is juicing this story. Apparently, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times is pretty pleased with the performance of the PA. He wrote in his op-ed that, quote, these new Palestinian troops, meaning the ones that Dayton has trained, are professional and real. What can you say in terms of the ongoing relationship between the promoters of this, neoliberal ideology of so-called democracy in occupied Palestine being promoted by people such as Thomas Friedman and the real on-the-ground policies by the U.S. State Department in Palestine? How is this playing out in the corporate media?
Well, it's important to understand the general project that's going on here, because at the beginning of the Intifada, you had in 2000, you had a network of checkpoints that effectively walled off Palestinian areas, but they did it through checkpoints, and there was ways around it through the fields and whatnot. But since 2003, as your listeners are well aware, Israel has been creating a massive wall that doesn't separate Israel from Palestine, but encircles Palestinian territories and ghettoizes, creating, anywhere between 4 major ghettos and 12 little island ghettos, depending on how you, how you qualify them. But this is the future of the Palestinian state. This is the two-state solution, is this idea of ghettos, which was really launched in 2003 by Ehud Olmert and Ariel Sharon in what was called the disengagement from Gaza. The idea was to pull out of the Gaza Strip, to leave 1.5 million Palestinians to their own devices within this tiny sealed-off ghetto, and to preserve the demographic balance for the State of Israel. And so what we're seeing in 2009 is the beginning, the incubation of the future situation where you have Dayton's forces, American-trained forces, dealing with Palestinian security subcontracted for the occupation inside these ghettos that are being built by the wall. And now you can't just in 2009, in front of the whole world, create ghettos and allow people to starve. I mean, even as abandoned as Gaza is, the whole world knows what's going on in Gaza and either chooses to ignore it or doesn't know what to do about it. But in any case, it's not silent what's happening in Gaza. And so Israel knows that there has to be some sort of pseudo, and the Western powers know that there has to be some sort of pseudo-legitimacy to these ghettos. And so this is where you have someone like Tony Blair and Thomas Friedman parachuting in with their World Bank, IMF, neoliberal type policies, where you create economic growth through a series of statistics that show that, you know, Palestinians are trading more, which is what Thomas Friedman talked about. You might have more coffee shops, more Starbucks, you know, these kind of sort of examples of economic progress that we would consider in, you know, in North America to be indicators of success. They use these as examples to show that the whole project is working, when really what's happening is that the ghettos are creating, which are sealed off now. In Bethlehem, you have effectively a Gaza in Bethlehem. There's no way out of Bethlehem without going through an Israeli checkpoint. They can close that checkpoint, and there's no way out. The wall completely encircles Bethlehem. The only way out is the same way it's the way to get out of Gaza, either through tunnels or through drainage pipes, but you're not getting out. The area of Bethlehem is completely encircled. And so the fact is that the checkpoints can be removed, like Thomas Friedman commented on, but Palestinian freedom of movement doesn't change. But what can be facilitated is certain, you know, national bourgeoisie elements, if you will, corporate elements that can profit off of the smoother transition of trade through the ghettos, and so they get Israeli access, more freedom of movement to trade their goods. And so this has created this sort of Tony Blair, what he calls the model cities, is like Bethlehem, where you can have tourists coming into certain parts of the city, seeing only one aspect of the occupation and then leaving the same day. But technically giving money to the Palestinian economy. And much like the Oslo process of the NGOization, there's money being made and statistics, are increasing, yet the average Palestinian is not feeling any of this, Thomas Friedman, economic glory, his Lexus and the, you know, olive tree type, formations, which Thomas Friedman has been at the forefront of extolling all over the world, the benefits of capitalism in complete disregard to all forms of statistics and objective reality that show that these policies have devastated people's way of life, traditional economies, and that's the case in the West Bank, where you have largely agrarian people being forced by the wall to become workers in, you know, what we would call maquiladoras or export processing zones. Here they're called, you know, industrial zones that are attached to either the Palestinian ghetto or to the Israeli settlement. You have a walled-off area where Palestinians are able to travel through through iris scans, through fingerprint, magnetic fingerprint, magnetic strip card, type, you know, futuristic management of movement allows Palestinians to leave the ghetto and go into this sort of secondary ghetto to work for the day and to make slightly more than, you know, subsistence wages and to go back home again. And in the economic model of the IMF and World Bank and Tony Blair, this is actually a dream because you have effectively migrant workers who go home at night. So rather than consuming Israeli resources or, you know, California's resources with migrant workers, you actually have the migrant workers coming to do the work, but then going home again at the end of the day. Now, what you have is because this is the future for the two-state solution, you're seeing the beginning stages in the last 2 years, 3 years maybe, the beginning stages of what they plan for the future of the Palestinians. And anytime someone like Thomas Friedman can use a platform like the New York Times to extol the virtues of this ghetto apparatus, you know, you have a real problematic situation because he can use statistics to show that the overall economic growth is happening, which of course glosses over the fact that the only reason it can happen is because Palestinians are trapped inside an 8-meter-high concrete wall, completely encircled by sniper towers, and only a select few are able to leave if they are, you know, squeaky clean in terms of resistance and able to pass their iris scan or fingerprint check. It's really a harbinger of a terrible future for Palestinians, and one that is, of course, visible in, you know, on the Mexican-U.S. border, and is a model that is looking to be exported elsewhere in the world.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, John Elmer. Let's talk more about the actual reality on the ground in occupied Palestine. And, you know, as I mentioned, the settler groups are becoming even more violent and vicious against Palestinians in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Netanyahu is taking a very revealing stand in terms of where he seeks to take the settlement issue. And once again, Israel is bombing Gaza. And in Gaza, the United Nations Development Program has begun removing the tens of thousands of tons of rubble from the Israeli attacks earlier this year. And they're uncovering massive amounts of unexploded munitions, including white phosphorus, mines, and explosives. And finally, in the larger context, you wrote a piece recently for Interpress Service about the ongoing turmoil faced by Palestinian political prisoners, especially women. Give us an update on that situation and really what's happening on the ground right now as we speak.
Well, I mean, just in the last week alone, there was 31 mechanized Israeli invasions into the West Bank. So you're talking, you know, four or five a night that are happening. So this is still going on. Gaza, as you said, is still being bombed, still being blockaded and sieged now 3 years on, at least 3 years where we've been discussing it. But, of course, it long predates that. You have settlers out on the frontiers of the ghettos because the wall is not complete. So the settlers are still battling for every inch of territory that they can get because, you know, the wall, although the Israelis don't say it's a border because they'd like as much territory as possible and don't want final borders, anyone who comes here to the West Bank or looks at the wall around Gaza can see there's a certain permanency to the concrete wall. And so in the areas where the wall is not complete, the Israeli settlers are the vanguard trying to literally push the state, you know, inch by inch out. And, you know, that's what Sharon called the cream of the Israeli people, the settlers who are at the are on the frontiers pushing, you know, on horseback with Uzis, shooting at Palestinians who try to farm their land so that the Palestinians don't farm their land, and then that land becomes fallow and under Israeli law becomes green space and then becomes taken over in this slow process of ethnic cleansing that's been going on for 60 years. So that's still going on today, and the settlers, as you said, call it the price tag policy, that any time their small little outposts are undone, that they're going to go wreak havoc, you know, in what Ehud Olmert called a pogrom on Palestinians. And so this dynamic has been what has shaped the state of Israel from day one. And so the fact that Netanyahu extols support for that is not surprising to anyone who's followed the history of Israeli governments interacting with the settlers. The settlers have always been at the forefront. And as you said about the smuggling tunnels, you know, you have this entire apparatus. We call them smuggling tunnels, but it's a forced smuggling where you have 130,000 people involved in an apparatus that's getting everything from cars to cows to cans of Coca-Cola into the Gaza Strip under this blockade. I mean, these stories just never make the news in North America, but you've had more than 130 people killed through bombing, poisoning, and collapse in these tunnels, both killed by Israel and by Egypt, enforcing this blockade. And still, all the while, you have a situation where Palestinians are being arrested every night by the Israeli occupation. 214 were arrested in the last week of July. And that, you know, makes the prison population today at more than 11,000 in an ongoing situation that touches every Palestinian family. So although Thomas Friedman writes that something is brand new here in Palestine, Palestinians see a lot of the same, a lot of the same old. And what's added on top of it is the fact that you have this Palestinian element now carrying out in collaboration with Israel. Something that's happening right under their noses and right in their neighborhoods every day. And so The situation here on the ground is not improving at all in any way. And if it can't be confused that the fact that Palestinians can move from one ghetto to the next doesn't equal freedom of movement. And the fact that there used to be 55 man checkpoints and now there's 24 doesn't mean that Palestinians can move more easily. All it means is that the wall has created a couple of major bottlenecks, which are called checkpoints, but would look to anyone, to a layperson in North America, would look like an international border crossing of the most aggressive kind, where you have armed soldiers pushing, yelling, lineups of cars going back miles. This is what they're talking about. They look like international border crossings, like terminals. They're not checkpoints where a couple soldiers are stopping and asking for IDs. So really what we're seeing is a transition point, I think, in the Israel-Palestine conflict, where you have the situation of an integrated policy of Israel trying to take the entire territory to the acceptance of a two-state solution, which is these ghettos, small Palestinian islands of autonomy within the state of Israel, with no borders to the outside world, no army to defend itself, only to attack itself. Independent foreign policy, but they have flags and stamps and economic statistics at the World Bank. A pseudo state is what the trajectory of this conflict is going to, and that's what they're calling a two-state solution.
Finally, John, before we let you go, I want to just get a few brief moments of an update on the Palestinian political prisoner situation that you recently investigated for Interpress Service.
Well, there was an important report released by the Prisoners Society, which is sort of an arm's-length agency of the Palestinian Authority. There's so many prisoners here in Palestine, upwards of 800,000 since 1967, in a population that is today 4 million and has doubled in the last generation. So depending on how you break down the statistics, you can have roughly 50% of Palestinian males have been at some point detained. And sort of lost in that massive apparatus of incarceration is the fact that 12,000 Palestinian women since 1967 have been imprisoned. And so based on this Prisoner Society report, I talked with a number of Palestinian women political prisoners to talk about their experience within the prisons. And, of course, the numbers are much smaller than the men. 850 women in the Second Intifada compared to 70,000 men. And so their organization and their resistance becomes all the more important because of their size and numbers. They're often ignored and often isolated for long periods of time within the prison to separate them from the male population effectively means solitary confinement. And they don't have the same access to educational resources and whatnot, and of course, not to those gender-sensitive living conditions. And so the women have really been at the forefront of organizing within the prisons. The Palestinians call the prisons the universities of the national movement because so many people are in them, and most of them are young and arrested at a time when they're at the sort of height of their political activism, but not necessarily at their education of the national movement. So the prisons become this very important organizing, political organizing space for Palestinians. And we've seen significant gains over the last 40 years within the prisons based on grueling hunger strikes and collective action, literacy classes, popular education going on, and just national project building. Many of the most important Palestinian political documents come from the prisons and are squirreled out of the prisons in various ingenious ways, including in tiny pieces of paper that are passed through fences and then reassembled on the outside as the prisoner's document, which is the key Palestinian reconciliation document between Fatah and Hamas, which was organized within the prison and has been completely ignored by the Palestinian Authority and in many cases by Hamas as well. But a very important organizing document for reconciliation that came about through the 1 or 2 hours a day of exercise, through communicating through the cell bars, from cell to cell, but also from prison to prison, through meetings with lawyers, and in various different ways that Palestinians have learned over the last 60 years, but particularly since the occupation began, to deal with the fact that incarceration is something that happens to every single serious political activist in the Palestinian arena. And incarceration is, in fact, probably the luckiest thing that happens to them, because we've seen more than 500 assassinations that have taken place over the last 25 years of Palestinian political leaders. So the prisons are key for Palestinians. No family is untouched by it. And it's really the center of gravity for the national project. And so it's a story, again, that's not often told in North America or in Western context. Yet one day on the ground here in Palestine will tell you that it's the most important aspect for Palestinians themselves.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. That's the voice of our special correspondent, John Elmer. John is a freelance photojournalist and a reporter with Interpress Service. You can check him out at www.johnelmer.ca. That's JONELMER.ca. Also at Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. John, it's always an honor to have you on the show. Please be safe, and we'll check back with you soon.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.